said of us who own them believe us.
Nothing really happened until I worked out that I could create
together on social media about the possibility that that person could be charged with hacking.
I think the market respects and rewards people who take risks and be themselves.
It's Monday, 6th of November, 2017, and welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode 6. Now, today we are lucky enough to talk to a gentleman called Nick Bowditch, or Bowditch. That's a good question. I can't remember how we should actually be pronouncing his name. Either way, Nick is one of the only people in the world to have worked at both Facebook and Twitter. Now, that itself is a pretty sensational claim to fame, but Nick is also a celebrated author. He's an in-demand public speaker, and he's also got a number of successful and also, interestingly enough, unsuccessful businesses under his belt. And we're going to get to chat to him about all of those, especially the unsuccessful ones, because they always make for great stories and for great learning as well. So we've also got our usual spin cycle segment with Eddie and Patrick, where we're going to talk this week about Donald Trump, cat poo and death. Just a normal, sensible week in the spin cycle. Before we do that, I've got a few thank yous as well, because I always feel that we leave these guys to the end and they should be right up the front. I'm going to thank Gilberto. He's our sound engineer, production guy. If you want to find out more about him, welovesound.audio. 20 years experience in audio. So if you're looking to do something in a podcasting space or audio space, go and talk to him. And also a big thanks to Steve from FC Digital. So that's fcdigital.com.au, who did all the creative stuff for the show. So the logo, the pictures, and all those bits and pieces. So big thanks to Gilberto, who's here every week with us. And also thanks to Steve. Finally, our Instagram account. If you haven't followed us already, what are you doing? Find us on The Simon Dell Show on Instagram. We post all of the pictures that you need that we refer to for the show. Plus, we also post some other random stuff that we find in the week. So without further ado, let's get on and go and see Eddie and Patrick in the spin cycle. Welcome to another edition of the Spin Cycle. With me are my co-hosts. We have the Facebook of co-hosts, Edwina Luck from QUT, and we have the MySpace of co-hosts, Patrick Condren. Welcome, you two.
I don't know what MySpace is. What's MySpace?
Surely you know what MySpace was.
I genuinely don't. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on WhatsApp. I'm on Instagram. I don't know what MySpace is.
That's exactly why he introduced you that way.
That's exactly why I used that as a reference to...
Anyway, hi, Simon. Hi, Pat.
Hi, everyone. Yeah, hi.
Now that we've got the ritual abuse out of the way, we can move on.
Do you know what? I've got a list of those here. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 more.
Nice.
And I'm thinking of new ones daily.
So we've got nine
anyway,
more
Pat,
shows.
Do you want to go first? Because I think I'd like to talk about yours first, Pat.
Someone on his last or her last day at the Twitter office deleted Donald Trump's Twitter account.
Great.
And has subsequently, via the internet, been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, stop.
And I've got to tell you, I'm struggling to find anyone that disagrees with it.
That's brilliant.
No, I thought it was hilarious.
It is absolutely hilarious. And what an F-U to Donald Trump, because he's possessed by Twitter, it is just fantastic. It was reinstated 10 minutes later, so it was only offline for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But he's heading off to China where the Twitter is banned. So I'd like to be in his suite when that happens.
Yeah. There was I read a good article that said, as funny as it is, it calls into question a little bit the security controls at Twitter that somebody on their last day could do that, because imagine if they hadn't done it, but they'd simply logged into Trump's account and gone something like, fuck it, let's nuke North Korea.
I got to tell you, could they do any worse than the man himself?
Well, There's that argument, yes.
It's interesting, isn't it? He's the only president since polling began to have a net approval rating below zero within his first 100 days in the White House.
That takes some doing. That itself is worth a Nobel Prize.
Nobel.
Noble. If you're from London like I am, it's Noble.
It rhymes Simon, with Goebel.
And Bell, Simon Dell, you know.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think that's I saw that this week and I thought that was one of the, you know. And the question is what happens to this poor person who was at Twitter and is no longer at Twitter? I wonder if there's any repercussions from them, for them, after now they've left.
They are talking today on social media about the possibility that that person could be charged with hacking.
Oh.
Even if he was so there an employee.
Given that some of the authorities in America have been arresting journalists who were reporting on riots, I don't think anything's beyond them these days. But I just thought that is absolutely hilarious that someone on their last day. I mean, you heard, you know, when George W. Bush was coming into the White House, the outgoing Democrats all prized the W off their keyboards so that when the new guys moved in, they didn't have a W. You know, that's funny in itself. But given that Trump relies and obviously loves Twitter so much to delete his account, it would have been, all praise to this person and long may they reign.
I'm sure they're going to have a colourful career in the media.
I'm sure they will.
I wonder where they've gone to work. I'd love to know where
they've
gone to
work.
We'll find
out. It's like,
well, I'm sure they will. It'll come out.
It's like exagisplaining and where has this guy gone? We'll hit on him.
Exagisplaining doesn't exist except in Simon's mind.
Eddie, stop starting him up again, Eddie. Okay. On that note, Eddie, what have you found this week?
Well, so you know I'm a bit of a pet person and we spoke about pets with Pat, Pet and Pat, last week with his dogs. Now, there are an estimated in Australia 25 million pets, which is obviously more than the population, and 97% of us who own them believe that their furry dog or cat friend are just as much as a part of the family as other human members. So my question to you, and I will get onto the story, but how much do you think people spend on their pets, guys?
An exorbitant amount. Vets, for a start, charge more than paediatricians.
Are we going per week or per year? What's the measurement here?
Okay, so that's a good. So how much of their disposable income, percentage-wise,
it's a percentage.
I suppose? Yeah.
1%?
20%.
1%, 20%.
I'm going 20%.
Yeah, one in four spend up to 30% of their disposable income on their pets.
30%?
And, wait for this one, many Australians spend three times as much on their four-legged friends compared to items for themselves, such as clothes, technology, a new phone, entertainment. And this is from statistics from Animal Medicines Australia.
No, they're making it up.
Wow.
No, they're not. I would say that they're undersaying. So last year we spent $12 million on our pets. We have one of the highest rates of pet ownership in the world. 63% of us own pets.
I can't imagine spending 30% of my wages.
Can you do me a favour and not tell Barney and Jackie at our place that that's the expectation?
Yeah, that's true. So there's two points to my story. The first one is this week IKEA have launched a new campaign that we will be putting on our Insta. The link to our Insta page. They have a new campaign detailing pet furniture and accessories aimed exclusively at the lucrative pet owner market. So, again, my question is, and I know that you haven't seen these ads, but is this a smart thing because I just hit you with those statistics, or is it just, IKEA is flat packs, it's furniture, but do you think it's really smart that they've targeted pet owners?
Are they expecting the pets to put the furniture together themselves?
Yes, therein lies the rub.
Yes.
And if so, they're going to have a problem using the Allen key without a opposable thumbs.
Exactly.
There's a flaw in IKEA's plan there. As smart as the Swedish are, there's a flaw there.
I think it's if we are genuinely spending 30% of our disposable income on pets, and is that only the cats and dogs?
Yeah, it is actually only the cats and dogs, and it's a beautifully crafted ad. Like, it's, you know, cats and dogs having fun. Mm.
If we are genuinely spending 30%, and I don't spend anywhere near 30% on the two dogs that are here, but if people are, why wouldn't a company like IKEA climb on board that statistic and say, here's something we can exploit?
Mm. Absolutely.
What's his – I'm trying to remember his name off Shark Tank. He's in that space, isn't
he? Yes, he is. Yes.
Whoever he is.
Green Cross
whatever
Vet.
Whatever his name is.
Yes.
God, yeah, Green Cross Vet guy. Because what he started doing, he's merging – and they've just done it the one round my corner, which I think is probably the smartest move I've seen. He had a – there was a pet store on one side of the road, and then there was a Green Cross Vet on the other side of the road. And they've moved the Green Cross Vet into the pet store so that it's part of the same building.
As they do with medical centers.
So they're saving on rent.
They have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they have the pharmacy next to the doctors. So it's only sensible that all of a sudden all these big box pet stores start having Green Cross Vets inside.
Absolutely.
Them.
It makes sense. It's a one-stop shop. And the other thing that I have to tell you guys that and Pat, I don't know if they've got a dog genie, but they've got a cat genie, which is this, and again, I will post a picture for everyone who's listening. It's this cat toilet that actually plugs into your washing machine. So when your cat goes to the bathroom, yes, it scoops it out and it's recyclable. I knew you'd say this, Pat, but it's amazing.
It's not amazing.
And it's, yes, it's not amazing. Thousands it's of cat. Dollars, but it's, it no, but people... People, a lot of people have indoor units. They live
in. I tell you what, people who buy this are indoor units.
Oh, where's your empathy, Gene?
I have no empathy. It's bad enough to walk the dog and have to stop and interrupt the walk to pick up the dog's shit.
Yeah, but that's exactly why there's this machine. It
why do you need a machine? Teach the cat to crap in a litter tray.
Well, or in a toilet. I think that, you know, a lot of cats do that. But this is an amazing, ingenious, cat genie thing that helps people who work all the time, who don't want to pick up that sort of stuff, and it flushes it out into the septic and it recycles the kitty litter. So it actually cleans the kitty litter and doesn't, you don't have to throw it out
if
after a day or two.
If you don't have time to empty the kitty litter, don't get a pet.
I'm sending you the link.
Don't.
It's amazing.
I can't believe I'm going to share a picture of this on Instagram.
Don't send me the link, Edwina, because the explosion you hear will be my head bursting.
I love how he calls me Edwina, but other time it's
Eddie. You know when you're in trouble,
Edwina.
Yeah.
It's like my parent. Simon, what are you talking about?
Well, quite frankly, I can't believe it's only taken us six episodes to get onto cat shit. it's downhill from here. So I'm going to talk about three Instagram accounts that I've found in the last week. And the reason I'm going to talk about them is because one of them I think is quite interesting. The first one I'm going to talk about is Bloonamies, which is obviously a created word. And I know how much Patrick loves created words. Mm-hmm. So if you go to Instagram.com, Balloonamies, it's basically you can buy balloons to send to people you hate.
I mean.
And I would love to be able to read out what's on some of these balloons, but sadly, well, let's just say one of them says, eat a bag of dicks.
Oh, okay.
So there's that was probably the most mild one of the lot.
Wow.
So if there's someone you don't like and you want to send them balloons, Balloonamies is
balloon,
your
all one word
is your balloon and then Amies, Emies.
Emies.
Well, there's obviously a market for it.
I think there's 2,293 followers. So clearly somebody is buying these balloons. My second one is one that I found on Reddit the other day. And he asked because he wanted some tips on how to grow his following. He reviews forks.
As in knife and fork.
Yeah. F-O-R-K. Not forks in the road. Forks as utensils.
I love it.
So he goes around to restaurants in whatever American town he's in and he takes pictures and reviews forks.
Fork porn. I love it.
He is the fork review.
Are you taking the forking piss?
No. At Instagram.com/ the fork review.
Hang on. I've just found the balloon amies Instagram site.
It's great.
That's hilarious. Great.
But check out the fork review. The fork review only has 348 followers, so he's quite new. So, but you can actually send him a direct message if you wish to have your fork featured.
Oh, that's gorgeous. Why would you?
Because you can, Pat.
That's not good enough anymore.
No, it's novel.
Who reviews the internet for the people that.
Well, there's a niche.
Knives.
I know.
There you go. We've just given someone an idea.
Who reviews the salt and pepper shakers?
Well, the knives might be a bit dodgy. Though.
See, salt and pepper shakers, I could understand.
True, sugar bowls.
You with me?
Maybe.
Because anyway. Sorry.
The reason.
Because you don't want to. Sorry, no, I'm going to finish that thought now.
No, go on then. Okay.
You don't want to go into a place, a dining establishment, and find that the pepper shaker, for example, has white pepper in it instead of black pepper.
They don't even have one.
You'd walk out for that, wouldn't you?
Yes,
that's exactly right. But that's the sort of thing you want to know.
Yeah,
not what the forking fork's doing.
Well, you can probably test the cleanliness of it. You can see that. But, you know, it goes hand in hand, Pat, I think, with the sugar and the salt, because if they've got the salt grains and, you know, people have stuck their fingers in, and you know the dirtiest part of someone's body, don't you?
Their bum?
No.
No, their fingers. Their fingernails.
Your bum would have to be dirtier than your fingers.
No, sorry.
Ooh. What happens when dawn breaks?
Let's not test the theory out. Let's just move on to the third.
Yes, what's the third one, Simon? This is exciting.
The third one is a Kiwi campaign, because we love the Kiwis. It's I Am The Swim Reaper. So Instagram.com/ I Am The Swim Reaper. And the point of actually having this conversation and bringing this to you today is that the campaign is about teaching people to be safe around water. It says, if you're going to make dumb decisions in the water, I'll be waiting. So it's basically an Instagram feed using the Grim Reaper in positions close to water. So he's on the beach, he's on the pier, all those kind of things. And it's done as though it were a proper Instagram account. And it has 71,000 followers.
Wow.
So my question really is death... Because the Kiwis tend to have a lot of campaigns where they make fun of death, where they make very light of it, not fun of it.
Mm.
And I'm just wondering whether you think that's more effective in stopping people's behaviours than, the classic drink driving campaign where they show, mutilated bodies and blood all over the place.
I think they've got to try something different because in a lot of years of doing the job that I do as a reporter, I've covered a lot of road safety campaigns, for example, and I don't think anyone has hit the right note when it comes to dissuading people from drink driving, from speeding. I don't know that shock and horror works. I think there has to be a multi-pronged approach to it. So why not? I suppose where I'm heading to is why not have a humorous look at it, because it's as good a chance of being effective as any other.
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you reckon, Eddie?
Yeah, absolutely, Pat. Fear campaigns don't work. And this is it's actually the photos are beautiful.
They are funny.
And so if people can actually get the connection between safety and death, then it will work.
And as I said, I think the Kiwis have had they've got form in this territory. I don't know if either of you remember the Ghost Chips campaign?
I do not.
No.
That was a road safety one, if I remember rightly. But it was one young Kiwi guy talking to a ghost of a friend of his, and they were talking about, you know, ghost chips and that kind of thing. So they tend to do these quite well and make light of the situation in an attempt to sort of, you know, cut through to that demographic. Because, and I think this is great that they've used Instagram in this way to try and, you know, to try and cut through. I think the other telling thing for me is there's no obvious call to action. If you go to look at the Instagram account, there's no go to this website to check out ways to stay safe in water. They're simply saying to people, if you don't behave near water, you could die. And they're doing it in a medium that a lot of people use. So
yeah, and it's not offensive, and I think having the not call to action, Simon, is actually probably a clever one, because people actually have to think about it and actually go, okay.
Anyway, that's all we've got for this week. And we've descended to the depths of cat poo. Let's hope that next week we can somehow recover ourselves from this.
I don't know. I'll find some animal story.
Once again, thank you very much to both Edwina Luck and Patrick Condren, who's back on the road with the premiere
I'm back on the road with the opposition leader, because I like to spread the love.
Anyway, thank you very much, guys. We'll talk to you next week. So I'm with Nick Bowditch. Nick has many claims to fame. At least I think he has many claims to fame. He might not think so. He might have more that I don't know about. And I first met Nick when he was working at Facebook. He was working at Facebook Australia down in Sydney. He's gone on to write his own book. He's a noted public speaker now. He's involved in lots of businesses and startups. So welcome, Nick.
Thank you, Simon. Gee, that's a kind introduction, mate.
I did that off the top of my head as well, would you believe? What I'd like to start off with is just you giving us a quick kind of potted history of all the things that you've maybe done that you think have sort of helped define you. So, you know, just a little, you know, 2-3 minute kind of,
sure.
Here's me, and this is, you know, these are things that people should know about me.
Sure. So, well, I'll work backwards. So currently, as you say, I speak at events and conferences. It's the majority of the work that I do now. I do a little bit of consulting with different companies and different small businesses and startups. I've come from a startup background myself, which I'm sure we'll talk about, where I've built and sold a few startups, and in the tech startups mostly. I am a successful and unsuccessful entrepreneur. I've had far more failures than I've had wins, but I've managed to have a couple of pretty significant wins, I guess, along the way. And I've worked for some big brands as well as worked in my own small businesses. So I'm a small business guy, but I have worked for a couple of big corporate brands, mostly in roles where I worked with how they worked with small businesses. And prior to that, I used to teach people how to scuba dive. Did that for about 8 or 10 years. And I live on the central coast of New South Wales in Australia. So I live about an hour north of Sydney, in just over the border into God's country. And I have 4 beautiful but feral little children in my charge as well.
And anybody that follows you on any sort of social media will see frequent pictures of
yes, I am an oversharer.
Them being feral. Yes. As most of the people who have children that I've spoken to so far are oversharers.
I never used to be. And in fact, I don't know how, before Facebook and Instagram, I don't know what people did who were parents. How were you proud of your children if you weren't able to show the whole world them?
You invite people around for those little slideshows? Do you know where you had them in the carousel?
No, you're a bit older than me, I think, so maybe that might explain that difference.
So the two things I really want to touch on there from that introduction, because maybe I'm some sort of masochist for you, but I want to understand a couple of your failures, because I think failures are really good at helping us define and...
Mate, I think it's the only interesting part, really. You know, honestly, I mean, from in terms of who are you and where are you now and what do you do and why should anyone be interested, I just don't think the successes are interesting. I think it's the failures that make you – well, the failures that you get up and keep going from are the ones that make you interesting.
So before we get onto that, I never knew you taught people to scuba dive.
Yeah, mate.
So because when I was looking at your LinkedIn profile the other day, there's a bit of a gap there, and I'm assuming that the gap now is the scuba – we shall call it the scuba diving gap.
It could be. So I left Australia for – I was away for 8 years and 2 days.
Right. So that was – you were out of the country teaching
people. Yeah. So I was about 4 years in Asia. I was about 2 years in Latin America, or two and a half years in Latin America. So I lived mostly around the Caribbean, Colombia and Honduras and Mexico, and I worked a bit in the South Pacific and a bit in Europe as well. Did 2 summers in Greece as well.
What made you abandon that then and come back here?
Ah, do you know what? Like, it was – everything gets old after a while. And I'd been away for a long time. I was severely homesick. And I realised too that I finally realised that I had missed so much. You know, brothers getting married, brothers having babies, sisters having babies, all my mates getting married. You know, and I was sitting on the beach in the Caribbean, loving life, but completely disconnected from my real world, you know. And I just got tired of it, actually. And so one day I just decided to go home and came home. And then about a week later I realised it was the worst decision I'd ever made because I had no money and no skills, no transferable skills, you know, and no kind of friend. Like, I had friends, but they'd all got married, or they, you know, everyone was changed, and I wasn't. And it was kind of a brutal little period, actually.
So is that where you sort of contrived that first startup?
Yeah. So I came back and I had no money and no prospects. And I was thought, well, I've got to get a job, you know, and there's no real diving around here, not that you can make any sort of income, you know, living from. So where I live anyway. So I thought, well, what do I know? You know, what can I do? And I'm like, well, I can travel. I know about traveling. So I got a job as a travel agent and I worked in Sydney. So I would do a two-hour commute, 2 hour back to Sydney on the train to sit in this little cubicle and be a phone monkey at this travel place that did everything offline. They had no online stuff at all. And I can just remember thinking, why am I here? Why are we all sitting here in this office when, you know, we could be all at home in our jammies doing this? We could be, you know, could all be online. And I sort of spoke to them about it a little bit. I wasn't an expert by any means. I had no idea, but I just thought, you know, someone can do this better. And I used to come home and whinge to my wife at the time. We had no kids then, but it was just me and her. And whinge to her about, you know, far out, man, someone should be doing this better. These guys aren't doing it properly, blah, blah. And so it was kind of decided that I would chuck it in and have a crack, start a small business, make it an online travel business and see how it go. We had very little to lose. When I started that first business, we had about $400 in the bank. And my wife was a full-time student at the time. So, the risk was very low. Put it that way.
Yeah. To lose anything. You've got to, I mean, when you do that kind of thing, obviously you've got to have, I mean, were you confident? Were you confident that you can make it work, or was it just,
No, I wouldn't say I was confident, but I was more motivated by the fact that, look, I hate this job. If it all goes tits up, well, I've only lost the job.
Yeah.
And our $400. And I'll just have to get another job.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a bad and good position to be in when you're poor when you're broke, I should say, not when you're poor, but when you're broke like I was, like, you know, the only way is up, but you're not particularly risk averse either, or I wasn't.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, bugger it, I'll just give it a crack and see how it goes. So.
And I read in your obviously I've been stalking your LinkedIn profile for this, but you mentioned
I don't even know what's on my LinkedIn profile, but this will be good.
Yeah, you need to go and have a look at it. but you mentioned I think it classic, and this is it was classic Nick Bowditch, because I read it and I just went, yep, that's him. And it's I'll read back your own LinkedIn profile to you. Never using any traditional marketing or advertising in print, radio, or TV. Instead, opting to build the business using solely social media marketing.
Yeah.
And what I find really interesting with that is that that was back in what, 2007?
2007, yeah.
So social media was in its infancy.
Yeah.
How did you, I guess the question is, what suddenly made you go, social media, that's the way to do it?
Primarily because I didn't have any money. I would have loved to, you know, so how's this? For instance, I had the $400, right, to start with. I spent most of that on a decal for my car. That tells you a little bit about what I knew about marketing.
Yeah.
Especially since I was building an online travel business and I spent $300 on a decal for my car. So, and it was a crappy car. Like, it wouldn't be the sort of car you'd want. Yeah, anyway, people to see you in. So I really didn't know anything else, and we were just losing – we just lost all our money. And and the only thing that sort of came back in all of my frantic Google searches, like how to run a business, conduct a business with no money, and so on, was put stuff on Facebook.
Right.
Build a profile online, and then people. I mean, the way I read it and the way it was put was, oh, the people will flock to you. It's easy, and they'll buy heaps of stuff from you and whatever. And it wasn't that easy.
Those are the days back in Facebook, and that's
yeah. Well, this
that's
was before you believed that,
didn't you? Yeah.
Well, and this was there was no ads then.
No.
So there was no paid content. It was all about
organic building relationships. 99%. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. Well, there wasn't pages on Newsfeed either.
Yeah. 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 Of course.
Like, we're talking, you know, the deep dark 2007, 2008 in Australia. So, but look, it was a matter of just necessity, really. I didn't have any money to put a newspaper ad together or a radio ad or anything like that. I had a free website, WordPress website, which I built, which is, you know, nickbowdish.wordpress.com or whatever it is when you don't own the domain, because I couldn't afford that. And and I buggered it up. We just went terrible, and nothing really happened until I worked out that I could create video content and that people would share it. And that was the savior. It was about 18 months after I created the first video content that we started to turn over $1 million in this little business, in which I was still running it at home, still without really any idea other than create compelling, engaging videos that people could relate to and they'll share it. And we started to make some money. So
what was that content? What was that compelling content in the day of 2008 internet?
It was relatability. So for instance, I would talk a lot about family travel. So early on, I worked out I needed a business coach. That was the first decision I made that was a good one, probably in my life. And so I got this business coach and I paid her whatever it was, and I couldn't afford it, but it was worth every cent. And she said to me, look, there's heaps of people doing this stuff. You need to be an expert in some kind of travel. And so I was like, oh, okay. Well, and I'm like, well, I think, you know, I could be dive travel, I could be Caribbean travel, you know, the thing that I knew. But then I realized, I sort of took a pun on the fact that, well, I could be family travel expert, you know. And so I invented this tagline. It was Nick Battage Travel, Australia's family travel expert, if you don't mind. And
wow.
And
wow.
I knew I didn't have a family and I never traveled with a family, but I knew that families were going to book more than one ticket.
Yeah.
Which meant more than one commission. And so that made it worthwhile when people were buying. And then what I sort of specialised a little bit further on was 2A3C travel, so two adults, three children, which you don't know yet, Simon, but it's very difficult to travel with three children. You need interconnecting rooms and where are you going to sit on the plane and all that stuff. And no one was really doing it. So we niched it down, and it was the best advice she ever gave us and I ever took was yes, you're going to lose some business here because you're not going to take some dude who wants to go on a Contiki thing. You're not going to help him. and you're not going to help more expensive, you know, river cruising geriatrics either. You're just going to concentrate on family travel. And I lost heaps of work and money. And it was really hard turning away work. But when we did and we niched down into what I wanted to do and what I knew would make us money, and we stuck it out, and then I started to make money.
In those early days of a business, as I know, is you pretty much want to just grab onto anything that walks in the door, don't you?
Oh, man.
And that's like a skill, saying no that early on.
And it was only because of those two powerful women in my life, my business mentor and my coach, who were saying to me, write it out, stick it out. You know, this is what you want to do. This is why we started. But it's really, really hard to knock back work when you've got no money. Yeah.
So what took you out of that? Did you sell that business? Did you just decide that wasn't something you wanted to do?
We sold the business. I had consultants working for me by the end, like literally consultants, not travel consultants so much as consultants. And they were travel agents as well, but they just had an ABN and we were paying them, and they were working under my brand more or less. And then what happened was the industry changed. The industry was shrinking the whole time in terms of commissions. When I left, you made 0% commission on, say, domestic flights. So you had to book land and insurance and packages and tours and stuff to make money. And the international commission was down to about 5% on a flight then. And I think it might be down now to about 2 or 3. So it's harder and harder to make money in that industry. So what I did was I wanted to get out. And so the consultants who I had working for me kind of pitched in, took the equity that they were each owed, and went off and did the same thing and kept it going for a little while. And now they're all doing their own things under their own names.
I was going to say, they took your name as well, did they?
They did at the time. Because, not that it was David Jones or anything, you know, it wasn't like a great name, but it was just enough that they just weren't ready to put themselves totally out there at that time.
Yeah.
And so they sort of sat under my brand for a little while after I left, and now they're all doing their own thing and killing it, which is great.
So after that, you then, the Bowditch Group?
So
tell me a little bit about that.
So after that, I failed about 5 times.
Well, actually, but maybe that's a good time to give us one of those failures.
Yeah,
but maybe one of the biggest crash and burns that you've got.
Well, they were all similarly big, because I tended to. Because what happened was I was kind of emboldened by doing all right after doing crap for so long, and then I did all right, and I started to get a bit cocky, you know. So I thought, well, we'll go off and do our own thing, I tried some import export stuff. I tried e-commerce a few times, I just wasn't cut from that cloth. I just couldn't quite make it happen and make it work. I ploughed a lot of money in a different thing. Not a lot of money, but enough money to go, Jesus, you know, when it didn't go right. But the biggest loss, I guess, the biggest failure in all of that was I was never actually doing something that was closer to my purpose, you know, something that I really wanted to do. And I didn't know what that was. Mm. I just knew I wasn't doing it.
Yeah.
And so the Bowditch Group sort of was a collection of businesses, I guess, different ideas and trials and stuff like that. And then I started to speak. So that was the thing that started to come mostly out of that time, was people were interested in how I built Nick Bowditch Travel, when no one else had really done similar things with Facebook at that time. So I kind of became, unreluctantly became kind of the Facebook guy. And started to speak at, you know, little business events and breakfasts and BNI stuff and whatever, and started to get me more confident around that, and thought, well, this is good, you know. I'm just really standing up, banging on. Like, I could do this anyway. So it went from there. And then the Bowditch Group morphed into Cluey. So Cluey was an agency where we had two focuses. And one focus was working with small businesses on their social media marketing effort. And the other focus was next generation mobile apps. So we built an app called Cluey Look, which used augmented reality. This is in a time where that was like,
I was going to say, that's, you know, that's early, early days.
It was very early on. And it was too early, as it turns out, because it was, people were just like, huh? So we built this app, and you would, put it over the label of your baked beans and look through the app at the label of baked beans, and you could trigger a PDF download or a contest entry or a video playing or something like that. It would use the augmented reality to augment a general marketing piece like a label or a billboard or a newspaper ad or whatever.
So just to jump in there, was that your idea?
It was my idea, and another guy who was working with for me then.
Right.
But we melded together 3 to 4 different technologies, which were each a bit of it at the time, under license and stuff, and created this thing, which I then sold. So it actually, and the people who sold it, the people who bought it, then just ran it into the ground.
So when you think, because one of the common themes that you meet with a lot of people who are entrepreneurs and have created businesses is this classic, as my friend, another friend Simon described, as entrepreneurial ADD, is that all these ideas keep coming to you and there's a danger that you keep acting on them. Did you find that was that's a problem for you? Or
oh yeah, yeah. It still is. Yeah. And again, those two influences in my life, my business coach and my wife, were very good with that. I would say to one of them, I would never say to both of them at the time because I knew I was going to get shot down by one. I would never put myself up, but I'd say to them, oh, I've had this idea, you know. And I always thought they were great ideas, yeah. And they may well have been, but one or both of them would say to me, how about you just finish the other 7 ideas you've had this week and, you know, we'll talk about it. And I just don't get shit done. I don't get shit finished. That's my biggest kind of character flaw when it comes to business, is I'm really good at starting stuff and I'm really crap at finishing it.
I think my wife continually calls me half-job Jerry because of,
yeah, you
know, there's that great idea, let's get it started, and then,
yep,
you know, then it tails off.
Look, to be fair though, Simon, I think you and I both share that, but I think we also both share that as a bonus too, because some people find that early days, that first 3 months, extremely difficult, and I find that first 3 months extremely easy.
Yeah.
It's staying with something. And I remember when I worked for other big brands and it was all sort of scrappy to start with, and then it became really kind of establishment and really organized and stuff like that. And I thought, oh, this isn't as fun.
Yeah.
You know, like this, and I'm out.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the clients that you worked for back in that day, that Bowditch Group day.
Look, they were mostly small businesses just like mine. They all sucked at social or didn't understand it or were afraid of it or were anti it.
Yeah.
So they just didn't give it any kind of resources or time or money. And so they didn't do any good on it. And all we had to do really was a little bit of ideation, a little bit of, oh, yeah, I think this would work, I think this would work, and then put the grunt in. And this is the problem then with, and I don't know if I have to tell you this, because you know this too, the problem with agency work around social media is that you just can't charge enough for it.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, nobody wants to do that grunt work. Nobody wants to post on the Facebook page of the hardware store like 3 times a week. And people don't want to hear necessarily from the hardware store or the real estate agent or whatever. They just need them when they need them. So it was a really difficult storytelling aspect to come to grips with, and you just couldn't charge anyone enough to make it worthwhile. So
yeah. It's not, and I find it's not really changed in the, you know, even in the evolution of 10 years of social media, we've still got this problem that, you know, that small business struggles with ideas and storytelling and communication. And at the other side of it, the consumer struggles with wanting to hear about it. It's, you know.
Well, that's the issue for me. That's the problem, is what do they want? What do they, if I am that hardware store, why would someone like my Facebook page?
Yeah.
And then A, and B, if they do, what the fuck do they want to know? Yeah. Like what, like do I talk about Kevin Spacey and do I newsjack things or do I talk about hardware? Because there's only so much talk about hardware, and you think, well, half the people who are liking the page probably want to talk about hardware. But then, you know, like everyone's so different. It's just a really, it's really, really hard.
And
it seems really easy, which means people won't pay enough money for it.
And I keep thinking about this real estate agent local to me who I sort of know as an acquaintance, and he started with a new agency, and he started posting these epic walkthroughs of houses that he's selling, and there the first one was exactly that. It was epic, and you know, drones and everything going off, and soundtrack and all that kind of thing. But after one of those, I'm like, I don't know how many of those do I want to watch? You know, maybe two or three, and after that, these aren't houses I'm going to buy. So,
well, that's the key, because and real estate is the hard. I reckon it's the hardest, man. I can't think of, or funeral director maybe is.
I was approached once by a funeral director asking to help on their social, and I was thankful they never went with me because I was.
Well, they did go with me. I don't know about the same ones, but we did have one, and it was really hard because you needed everything needed to be subdued, obviously.
Yeah.
And reverent and whatever, but everything needed to be really well lit, really high quality. But the problem with real estate and funerals is, from an agency point of view, or from a social point of view, is people only need you when they need you, and they don't want to hear from you otherwise. Like, who wants to hear from a funeral place?
So with that in mind, if you've now taken the social cap off, what if people are listening to this and they own a funeral directors or they own a real estate agent, what would you suggest to them now in terms of keeping them front of mind and you know, to their local community?
Yeah, I would try to be the most influential and front of mind voice in the community. That's the only thing that worked, and I think it's still the only thing that works, is when the real estate guy talks about, so I live on the beach here, or a beach suburb here. The real estate guys should be talking about beach sand erosion just around the corner from here, climate change, overfishing, traffic snarls, marriage equality. Yeah, you know, like things that matter to people, but not necessarily. So I think it's too easy for us to go, well, no one wants to hear from the real estate agent about marriage equality. But if I'm trying to decide between two different real estate agents to sell my home, and I know how one stands on an issue like that, even if it's not in agreement with my stance on it, I'm more likely to go with that person because they are real and they are authentic and they are willing to take a stand on something and say, this is how I feel, and that's compelling for me. So I would try to be the most compelling, influential voice in the community, no matter what you're selling.
And I think that also pays dividends as well when you ask, you know, a lot of people go on Facebook and ask their friends, can you recommend a real estate agent? And if that real estate agent has been talking about something, it's amazing how that then lends itself to a referral.
And it's funny how many times I refer somebody or some brand or some business to somebody else who I've never spoken to.
Mm.
And I don't go, oh, these guys are awesome. I go, oh, try these guys. They're all over Facebook. I see them all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that lends legitimacy.
What other things have you learned from that sort of startup space and the small business space that you think, you know, those things that you say when you start working with a new client or a new business that you go, right, well, here's the things that we've, the basics that the people have got to get right.
In social?
Oh, no, in anything, in business in general.
You're never going to be ready. Stop saving up and just start. That's the biggest thing for me is the biggest conversation I have with startup people and small business people now, the most repetitive conversation is someone says to me, look, I've got this job, I've got this career, right? And it's well paid or it's whatever, it's standard and it's safe and it's secure. But I've got this idea and I've started to sell these things and you know, I'm selling a few of them now and I just can't make the jump to leave my full-time job into that. And I know that you've no doubt had this conversation with people. And my response to this is always a little irresponsible, actually, but my response is always, dude, when are you going to be fucking ready? Like, just have a crack. But, you know, obviously if you have a mortgage and you have children to feed and whatever, there's a difference there. But and that was why I was – it was good for me to have nothing when we started because I would have lost it for sure, whatever we had. But that's the biggest thing is people wait and wait and wait and then it'll be too late or someone will have done it else or whatever, and that. And that's the second thing is people say to me, for instance, I heard from one of my clients was saying to tell me the other day, he referred a guy who has this startup idea to a app developer. Right. And the app developer told his mate, oh, that's already been done. Someone's doing that, and talked him out of it.
Wow.
And I think that is really prevalent, where people think they need to be the only person with the idea or with the technology or with the whatever capacity, otherwise they're not going to start. You know, and if that was the case, there'd be no Samsung, there'd be no LG, there'd be no, you know, there'd be no Virgin Airlines, there'd be no Jetstar, there'd be like a lot of brands would never have started. It doesn't, you know, there's 7.5 billion people. There's plenty of fish in the sea. So that's probably my two biggest lessons.
It's interesting you say about taking that jump because, I had this conversation with a previous guest and it was from a book I read by a guy called Cal Newport. The book is So Good They Can't Ignore You.
Oh, have you read that? I saw it on Facebook. I saw something about it on Facebook.
It's interesting because he has a slightly different angle on it. And I definitely think it's obviously a book that I heartily recommend to everybody. He has a couple of points, but one of the points that I like is that he talks about building up career capital. And if you're in a job that you don't like, is that you should spend the time building up capital in yourself, education, knowledge, and that when you then move into a business or a startup, whatever it is, move into a business or a startup that uses the career capital that you've built up in your previous role. So his argument is, if you're an accountant, don't go and start a yoga school because you don't know anything about yoga and your career capital you've built up won't help you in that yoga school. But if you're an accountant, go out and do something that uses your career capital and that you're passionate about. And his other point is that the more career capital you get and the better you get at the job, that's when you find you find your purpose. It's not the other way around. You don't sit there and go, here's my purpose. Now I'm going to go off and do this. So it was quite an interesting take on it that I thought turns that on its head a little bit.
Yeah, it does. I like that though, because I think too many people do decide what they're going to be.
Yeah.
And then try to work backwards over, you know, what I have to do. You know, I'm going to try this and fail. And I think that having said that, every success and failure I've had, I have had that career capital in. It's not, you know, I haven't tried anything outlandishly different.
Yeah.
It's been the execution, my execution.
Well, I mean, he obviously said there's some other factors in that as well, but, you know, it's sort of, he uses a lot of good examples where people have, you know, in their early 20s have said that, you know, have put their sort of stake in the ground and said, this is what I stand for and this is what I'm going to do. And then 2-3 years later, they're a complete failure because, you know, they haven't got that capital in themselves to build that purpose around them. So it's an interesting point anyway, but.
And I mean, if you think about it, you know, Zuckerberg was already a coder.
Yeah.
Elon Musk was already a coder. Like, they haven't necessarily started something drastically different to.
The good example he uses was Steve Jobs, because Steve Jobs wasn't overly interested in building computers when he first started off.
But Steve wasn't it.
Well, exactly. There's another book I've read where all those good creative people tend to have a doer next to them. And that's the same with Gates and you know, Jobs. They all had that person next to them who could activate the dream, as it were.
And it's the same with Zuck, actually. I mean, everybody in that business complements him in some way, and it's a very smart way to.
So let's talk about the time at Facebook and Twitter, and I don't really want to dwell on it too much because I don't think it's you know, there's a lot of things I'm sure you learnt there, but I'm not sure a lot of the lessons are wholly appropriate or wholly useful to people in that sort of business. But I'm really keen to sort of find out some of the key things that you did take from Facebook and Twitter as well.
Yeah, I tell you, from Facebook especially, so I was there for about 3 years, just over 3 years. I learned something new every day. I was able to work alongside and sit next to geniuses every single day, literally geniuses every single day. I was the dumbest person in every meeting I've ever been. But that was fine with me because I was able to learn, and because they really, most of these brilliant people I worked with at Facebook especially, couldn't say what they wanted to say to the people they wanted to say it to. They couldn't phrase things. They couldn't communicate and connect with people as well as I could. Likewise, I didn't understand data the way they did, or I couldn't code the way they could, or whatever. So it was I filled a role there. The best thing I learned there, the biggest thing I learned there of all the things I learned there was the value of inclusion of your team on the journey. The buy-in you get from your people, it was easily the standout thing that I learned there. Zuck does a Q&A every Friday afternoon for an hour where he gets up in front of the entire workforce and encourages people to ask anything they want. And he's extremely open about answers he gives and whatever. When you work there, everyone from the person cleaning the dummies right through to Mark knows everything about the business. You are really empowered and you're really included and you drink the Kool-Aid. You really do. You are part of the.
Do you think that's something an average business owner could do themselves?
Oh, absolutely, but they don't. I think. So conversely, so at Facebook, everyone knows everything and you literally know everything. You know all the nifty stuff that's coming down the pipe, things that they're building, trouble that we're in or money that we're not making or products that aren't working as well, right? And then you look at businesses like Apple, where in the Cupertino office, the campus at Cupertino that Apple is the big circular campus, there's some parts of that building where some people employed there can't go. There is literally doors you can't go in. And I just don't think it would have the same inclusive effect. I know people who work at both brands. Mm. I know that that's true. And so I often ask small business people and startup people, what business are you running here? Are you running Facebook where everyone's included, or are you running Apple where some people can't go in that door?
And it's funny because, they're both a success in their own way.
Oh, of course, but of course. I mean, I would challenge and say how much more successful could Apple be if everybody knew about everything? Obviously, they're terrified that somebody's whatever's behind that door being built or planned is going to be leaked. But the underlying thing of that is, it says, what does that say to the employee? It says, I don't fucking trust you. And that's not a good place to be.
So what do you think? I mean, Facebook has evolved obviously a lot since, 2007 when he started using it for that travel agency. Where do you see these platforms, where do you see them evolving to next? And I know you're not there, and I know it's a bit of a, random.
No, I'm not there. And to be honest, I don't ask the people who are my mates there about very much. Although I occasionally have serious FOMO and really want to know, I mostly have kind of.
I tell you what. Sorry to interrupt. But FOMO has been a constant thing about everyone I've spoken to on this podcast so far. I keep making the joke about how we give millennials shit for FOMO, but it doesn't change. It just evolves into a different kind of FOMO later on in life.
Well, and the truth is that all of us Gen Xers have great FOMO of millennials. Let's be honest. So I don't know for sure where it's going, but I know that there's a great investment in AI and AR and VR. That there's still I think that we'll look back in 5 years and two things will have happened. So here's your soundbite, mate. That I'm sure you'll play in 5 years when it hasn't happened back to me. But here's my thing. In 5 years, I think Instagram will have more monthly active users than Facebook does. And I think that Facebook in Oculus, in virtual reality, will be used far more effectively and more densely than Facebook on a laptop or even a mobile.
Okay.
I think that it's that will be on the back of machine learning and artificial intelligence completely changing the way everybody markets.
See, I have a big challenge with both AR and VR in the fact that I believe that no matter what you do, the end consumer does not want to put something on their head, on their face, on their head.
I totally agree with you, but I also think in 5 years
it'll just be projected in front of them by
something. Yeah.
We've got we've got one of those free roaming VR, whatever you call them. Not exhibitions, it's a game. Really where I see VR going as an entertainment, not necessarily in home, but somewhere that you could go for 2 or 3 hours in the same way that you would go to a cinema. I think VR will kill the cinema because, quite frankly, I'd rather go and experience a zombie outbreak in VR than I would go and watch, the latest romantic film with the wife. But
I think also just on that, I think it's going to seriously threaten the travel industry, because I think as VR improves, if I can sit in my home and for free be on the Serengeti and watch wildebeest and elephants walk past, and it's really good, am I less inclined to save up and spend money to go to camp?
Good point. Just on that then, taking the next step, what are some of the other brands that you sort of admire and always return to? I know there's always an ongoing conversation. I think I saw it last weekend about the Qantas versus Virgin debate. I know you're not a fan of Virgin. I'm a Virgin traveller. I wouldn't go Qantas, but what are some of the other brands that you like that you would always buy that impress you?
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because I'm not particularly brand loyal.
Yeah.
Generally, but I'll only buy Kleenex Cottonelle toilet paper. And seriously, if they put 100 in a packet, I'd fucking buy that. Like, the bigger the packet, the better.
That's not the brand that I was expecting you to say, but fantastic.
Oh, that would be one of my top five favorite brands. Qantas, I just think there's so much to love about Qantas. I mean, there's the nationalistic part of me that loves it. There's the storytelling part of me that loves it. I just don't think there's better.
Have you seen their recent in the market TV campaign? Anyway. They've got one where they're talking about the people behind the Qantas brand. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So that started on social. So interestingly, they're kind of not leaking at, but like going social first, right, with a lot of their brand, with a lot of their brand campaigns, which is really interesting. Right? Imagine 5 years ago someone doing that. Like Facebook would be the last place you'd try something, not the first. But I just love the fact that they can tell the story of the traveller without ever showing the equipment, the planes, the meals, the food, the legroom, any of that stuff, and you don't care. And I know as a frequent flyer, they just look after you in a way that actually rewards brand loyalty in a market where I just don't think it is rewarded very often. And I just love them. But that said, I had to fly. I had to fly Virgin last week. For some reason, and it wouldn't, honestly, mate. This is the point about brand loyalty. It could have been the best experience in my life, and I still would have said, "Oh yeah, it was all right." So that's when you know you're winning. And I'm an Audi fan, AUDI, Nate, not ALDI. So much, brands. I think the real constant thing with me is brands that don't try to be something else.
Right.
Brands who go, do you know what? Someone's got to be the most expensive here. It might as well be us. Fuck the rest of you. This is what we're doing, and we're not gonna lay down for that. We're not gonna try and twist ourselves around. Mercedes Benz now have a model of car that's $29,990, and they do that because they weren't getting 22 to 26 year old women buying their cars, and they really wanted them.
Yeah,
and I think that's really the wrong thing to do.
It's that authenticity that I think, whether you're Audi or whether you're the local real estate agent or the, local funeral home, that making sure you're authentic in that marketplace, saying this is who we are, and just being honest and transparent with people.
Yeah. Because you can't that's fake a massive, it,
No.
And I think on those lines too, like, that's why Snapchat, for all its problems, that's why it works for some brands and some people. It's certainly why Instagram Stories and Instagram Live and Facebook Live works, because You can't fake that. It's not a do-over. It's not an edited version. It's real in that moment. Somebody's literally doing that and they're taking a risk to do it. And I think the market respects and rewards people who take risks and be themselves.
Last couple of questions for you. You've obviously met a lot of people on your travels. You've spoken at a lot of organisations. What organisations or what people have you met that you've gone, you know, that really impress you, people that you would go back time and time again to listen to or be part of, organisations that you'd be part of? Or
certainly, at Facebook there's a long list, really.
Yeah.
But part of that might be my unconscious bias because I had definitely drunk the Kool-Aid by then.
Yeah.
But I would say the two standouts for me there, neither of them are Zuck, actually. One is Sheryl Sandberg. I just found her in person to be such a formidable yet compelling and convincing person that and keep in mind, you know, she spends a lot of her day in a room with a whole lot of white old grey dudes talking about policy and talking about investment. Yeah. And yet she can still have the same cut through with them as she does with the younger Facebook workforce and women generally. I think she's a very compelling character. The other person at Facebook who impressed me more than anybody else is a fellow called Chris Cox. So Chris is the VP of product. He was one of the first handful of people that Mark got on board. And the most compelling and interesting thing about, impressive thing about Chris is that he does a talk during the new hire orientation week on the first Monday at 10 a.m. The very first person who speaks to you is him. And he tells a story about, you know, how Mark approached him to go and work at Facebook, this thing that he was calling the Facebook, had no money, no employees, and had big plans and whatever. And Chris said, "Don't be stupid, this is shit house, I'm not going to do this. Like, this is never going to make money and no one's ever going to advertise on it. How are you going to make money, you know?" And anyway, Zuck was able to obviously coerce him and convince him to do it, and he's there still. But he tells this story at 10 o'clock every Monday. And when I heard him say it the first time at my new hire orientation, you know, he might have said it 1,000 times. And a few years ago, when I was just before I left the book, I snuck in and listened to it again. And it might have been the 4,000th time he told. I don't know. My math could be completely off here. But it would be, wouldn't it? Anyway, whatever it was, he sounded like it was the first time he'd ever said it.
Wow.
And no PowerPoint or any gadgetry, anything like that. He just sat on a chair at the front of the room and told this story. And every person in the room is on the edge of their seat, completely engaged. You know, that's impressive.
Yeah.
The other person, from a speaker point of view, probably the best speaker that I've worked alongside or on the same gig of was Todd Sampson. So Todd's he's on the Gruen Transfer. Like
yeah, the transfer hack your body guy.
Body hack guy, life hack guy.
Yeah, that's it.
Super clever fella.
Yeah.
But just, again, someone who can make very difficult concepts seem very simple, and that always impresses me because I'm kind of the other way around. I take the most simple things and make them completely difficult and bamboozling. But Todd's a very impressive guy, and those sorts of people I've been very fortunate to work with and meet and call friends, which is nice.
Fantastic. So we'll wrap it up here. I'm just kind of interested, sort of, what's next? What's next for you? Where do you go from here? Not literally, because obviously you're waiting for the kids to come home.
Yeah, the kids are about to get home and all hell's about to break loose. That's not me.
We've got to wrap it up quickly before that happens. Yeah. No,
I've written my second book, follow-up to the first one, which will be available shortly. I'm in the process now of writing the third one. Then I'm going to have a break from writing for a while. I'm really interested in the stuff that I'm doing now for Lifeline. So I'm an ambassador for Lifeline in Australia, which is a suicide prevention hotline organisation. Fantastic.
Yeah,
and I'm also an ambassador for the Carers Foundation, which is based in Queensland, where you are. And their motto is "We care for carers." There's 3 million carers in Australia, looking after someone in their life, and none of them put up their hand for that.
Yeah.
So you know that sort of work I'm really interested in, and just speaking now at conferences, I speak more now about mental health and suicide prevention than I do about marketing and startup, but I still occasionally delve into both, which is nice. But my next thing, mate, I don't think it's been invented yet, actually. So maybe it's, you know, maybe it's selling Serengeti VR platforms. But
Well, put me down for the first one.
I'll send you a sample.
How did you find writing? Do you find that a soothing experience or a like intensely painful?
Do you know experience? What? I'm fortunate. It comes very easily to me.
Okay.
The editing process is more difficult because I can be a bit of a know-all and a bit whatever. But my editor is fantastic, and she just says no. That's shit. Here it is. It's better. And I go, okay. But no, I quite like it. I think it's cathartic, you know. Yeah. It's a lovely thing when it's done. Yeah. Put it that way.
Yeah. So if people want to talk to you, if people want to ask you a question, if they want to buy your book or hear you speak, what's the best way of getting a hold of you?
Best thing is to go to nickbowditch.com.
Yeah.
The best way to contact me is through Facebook or Instagram. I'm at Nick Bowditch across all the socials.
Yep.
And that's probably the best way to get hold of me.
Fantastic. Mate, it's been a pleasure. I think there's probably a whirlwind coming through your front door in a few minutes'
In about 2 minutes from now.
So I'm going to give you 2 minutes to prepare for that. But I just want to thank you for your time. There's some really interesting stories there, some fantastic things that I think people will find extremely useful and hopefully they can apply to their own business and their own life. So thank you very much for your time, mate.
You're welcome, champ. Thank you.
And just like that, we've come to the end of another Simon Dell show. This was episode 6. Now, just before we close, if you get a chance to rate and review us, we would most appreciate that. We've had a few already, so thank you to all those people who've done that. But if you can get on iTunes and give us a rating and a review, that would help us out greatly. If you want to contact me, you can find me at simondell.com. You can find me on Instagram, I am Simon Dell. You can find me on LinkedIn, Simon Dell. Pretty much just punch my name into the internet and I'll pop up somewhere. But I would really appreciate if you want to make contact with me, please do. And if you've got any questions, if you'd like us to discuss anything, either within the normal Simon Dell show or you would like to us discuss something in the masterclasses when I sit down and talk with Simon Bell, then we'd love to do that. So please feel free, ask us some questions, send us some topics. Get involved. We'd most appreciate that. Until then, we will see you next week.